Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCOU 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Oh my.
All right, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm sitting at the controls, Al Warren. And my co-host today is John Copenhaver. Thank you for being here, John.
Hi, Al. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. Now, we've got quite an interesting guest who's just blowing all the doors open all over the place. And he's got a new book that's a number one bestseller in LGBT thrillers. And you know him. You've been around, so you know him. And this is the first time I've met him, but it's a pleasure. So welcome to the show, PJ Vernon.
Hi. Thank you all so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to get into this.
Oh, well, we'll see. We'll see at the end of the show if you're still happy. So, well, PJ, first, before we get into the new book, where did it start for you? And I mean the writing part of things. Like, how did you decide to become a writer and actually venture out to get something published?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've always been a storyteller my whole life. I remember being a kid and, you know, I'd pop a VHS Disney movie or whatever movie into the DVD, and it would be on for maybe pop the VHS into the DVD, into the player. maybe we're like 10, 15 minutes in the movie, and instantly I'm running upstairs to grab my figures to like play it out how I feel like, you know, it should go, because, you know, just story really is something that's always been important to me. Of course, always tried to write. When I was younger, in high school specifically, and then I took a big old detour to grad school, became an immunologist, and most of my writing was scientific. So it actually wasn't until I abandoned gainful employment and moved to Canada with my now husband Barry, that all of a sudden I had some time on my hands to take writing seriously. So I really started trying to make this happen in 2016 when I moved up here.
Well, that's interesting. But what was the catalyst, but not only just timing and moving to Canada, but what was the catalyst that made you feel, brave enough to actually put something out for everyone to read?
Yeah, the only thing I would change is I would say the cowardice, just because I kind of didn't have a choice. Queer kid coming from John's neck of the woods in the southeastern U.S., I went and got all this education and terminal degrees because I was insecure. And when I made a choice to leave that for my personal life, I underestimated sort of how much I had defined myself by those and nothing else. And so when I yanked the rug out from under myself and found myself in Canada without that, you know, on the other side of that sort of trauma hit, so to speak, I was like, I've got to do something. This is something I've always loved. I was an immunologist for the Defense Department, so there wasn't really a job I could just move into here in Calgary where I am now. I was like, here's my shot. Let's do it. There was that, and there was another moment. I was in a bookstore, and I was looking around, and I was like, there's thousands of books here. I would recognize almost none of these folks in an airport if I saw them. So really, maybe I can do this, and maybe it's not Stephen King or bust, you know? So that was a powerful moment, I'd say, when I was able to take myself seriously as a writer.
Did that help with your insecurity, like actually putting the book out?
Oh, yes. I didn't realize it before. I never think things through. I have ADHD. And so until after it's too late, then I consider, you know, all of the consequences. And I was like, I just want to write a thriller. I want it to be queer. I want to be able to draw upon the same lived experiences every author does when they're creating their works. I wasn't thinking so much about my insecurities or how it would feel after. But then once the book was out in the world, about a week or two later, I did have a moment where I felt this. I was on a walk and I felt this incredible catharsis because I did have a lot of things to say, you know, through my storytelling that I hadn't been able to do. And I underestimated how powerful that sort of catharsis would be. And the insecurities, I would like to say, were mitigated by my own personal growth and understanding. But it was really just the validation from readers. There were, you know, quote unquote, mainstream thriller readers that didn't seem to give a crap if, you know, my book involved queer characters or what characters, as long as it was a good story. So when they started telling me it was a good story, that, as all writers can relate. That mitigated my insecurity. External validation is always great.
Yeah, it's a nice thing, you know. It doesn't happen enough. But, you know, so the theme of the book, you know, it's a crime thriller. It was really important for you to have gay characters.
Absolutely. It was so important because that's who I am. And that allows me sort of unfettered access to my own, again, lived experiences, history, friends, families, things folks have told me or that have happened to people that I love that otherwise I might have to reshape or reform to make it fit into a different novel that doesn't include someone like myself on the page, having crimes done to them just like anybody else, right?
Mm. So how do you get your characters? Like, where do they come from for you?
They come from things that are, they're sort of a patchwork quilt of different things that I've either encountered in my life or that have led me to think of, you know, to have this moment where I'm like, oh, that'd be cool. So things that are sticky, if, you know, if a friend shares a particular experience happen to them, and it really resonates with me for some reason, that's sort of a gut instinct thing. And I'm like, oh, if that really popped to me, let's file that away, because chances are maybe that would pop to someone else, particularly if I could, you know, change it and fictionalize it and up the stakes. So really, it's the characters come from almost like a feeling. Like I had a feeling I wanted a character like Oliver. And, you know, once I had sort of set up how this book would open, it became a mining process of going through all of these things, these sort of memories, these sticky things that people have said or done, or perhaps that have happened to me. And maybe, you know, I was very anxious in a situation that didn't turn out to be dangerous, but what if it had become dangerous, sort of thinking. And so once I sort of have a feeling of what I need, what kind of voice I want for a particular character, you know, that's kind of all I need to start with. And then I can just sort of figure them out, as I go, especially if I've kind of worked out, you know, their moral compass and what their perceptions are of sort of right and wrong and in between from the get-go and how that might change. So it all starts with a feeling, I guess, would be a way to say it succinctly.
A feeling of sticky things in a bathhouse.
Who would have suspected? Who would have known?
You know, one thing that I really loved about Bathhouse was sort of the scrutiny it was giving a gay marriage. I don't know if you had any of this occur in your life, but I know that when gay marriage became a possibility, the first thing all my straight friends asked my partner Jeff, now husband, was, when are you getting married? When are you getting married? Like, it was the thing to do. And I was like, well, wait a second, guys, you know, you're just going to get married because you can. Like, you know, you get married because ultimately you're, you know, this is something you commit to. So, you know, I think there's a lot of times mainstream culture wants to cast gay marriage as a sort of perfect, blissful, you know, somehow the gays are getting it right. You kind of took a fraught gay marriage and explored it. Was that intentional, or why were you doing that?
I got to say, first off the top, that's absolutely happened to me during that whole conversation. I remember being so frustrated because I'd be, you know, in queer spaces with friends who had all of these different opinions of, oh, okay, well, now, just like you said, marriage is accessible, so we should all go do it because that seems like a great decision no matter, no matter what. But then on the other side, there were other folks who were sort of rejecting, you know, everything that marriage, you know, all the baggage of marriage that came along with it, and sort of the patriarchal system that it's, you know, sort of set up around. And,
right.
And you know, and so I found myself, you know, much younger at the time, thinking, well, where do I fall on this? Because I agree with aspects of, you know, my friends who are saying, you know, screw this. But on the other hand, I'm like, I was in a relationship at the time, and I would have really appreciated, you know, that my boyfriend at the time wasn't a U.S. citizen, you know. So right off the bat, there was a huge systemic barrier for us that had real life consequences. So definitely it happened to me. I think for the in the book's case, it was very important to show readers that all we're really getting is access to the same opportunities for happiness and to thrive, and the same opportunities to find ourselves in toxic situations that aren't good for us. And, you know, I think because so many of us, at least myself, and for so long, had so much shame and self-hatred, I mean, it really became, in a vacuum of representation, you know, a breeding ground for all kinds of behaviors and codependencies and things that maybe if you know, we'd been a little more normalized, might not have happened. And so I think it's really great. I appreciate seeing that in fiction when I see messy folks navigating challenges that might be something I could encounter. And then therefore, because I've seen it in pop culture, navigate that challenge a little bit differently. Because whether we like to admit it or not, I mean, at least for me, pop culture is where I get a lot of points of reference of, you know, how, sure, how I should navigate anything.
What do you want people to take away from the book?
I, first and foremost, want them to look up and be like, oh, that was a flight from New York to Los Angeles that just blew by. Or, you know, that they put it down and they're like, wow, that was fun. There was an entertainment payoff. I'm a really big fan of what S.A. Cosby said about Razorblade Tears, which just came out a couple days ago and is just a terrific book. He frames it as, you know, he quotes Mary Poppins, where he says, you know, the sugar, a little bit of sugar helps the medicine go down. And so he you know, says he gives sugar in the form of this riveting plot, but then there's a little bit of medicine because folks step away and learn from it. And so what I would like folks to maybe take away is, you know, these people that aren't like you are just, it's just as easy to cultivate empathy for them. Their stories are just as gripping as long as they're, you know, the reader's jam. And, you know, at the end of the day, it shouldn't matter what kind of community any character comes from. And so I hope that when folks put the book down, even if they say, oh, P.J. Vernon didn't write my favorite book, or I didn't really care for this specific book, if there is another queer title, another queer author that's coming up, they're going to say, you know, they're going to give that book a shot. Maybe they'll do it better. You know, they'll find that story, as opposed to thinking it's not for me because it's, you know, different from me, which I haven't really encountered a lot of, and it's been really encouraging.
Yeah, well, it's still early.
True.
Now, do you write, when you write this, the bathhouse itself, do you write that as a character?
I do. I definitely treat scene and atmosphere specifically as a character with its, you know, like, what does it have at stake? What does it want? What's, you know, preventing it from getting it? And which is not, you know, maybe the best way to sort of lay it out because it's, you know, personifying this building. But it's very important to, you know, make sure that, like any character, it's been fully fleshed out, that there's a real palpable sense of mystery, suspense, of danger, and making sure that, you know, you include details for the reader to be able to tap into that. So, you know, in the bathhouse, everything's obscured, it's steamy, it's jungle hot and sweaty, and I joke, it's all those words people hate, damp and moist, and, you know, I just, put the word moist in your manuscript, and it will carry so much terror for you, for your readers, because it really is, like, it's that claustrophobic, confining cage, and if we're to believe the character is going to undergo some sort of change and be able to escape whatever problems are happening on the page, then, you know, the setting and the scene also undergo changes. So maybe the first time you encounter the bathhouse in the book might not be the same as the second time, or when folks are talking about it somewhere else later on in the story. So it very much is a character. And on the flip side, to contrast that, so was their Georgetown townhome, very much a character in stark contrast with the bathhouse, very nice and ordered and neat and hopefully not dangerous at all.
The bathhouse, moist and easy.
There you go.
Were you worried about presenting or calling it bathhouse? In the sense of the title in itself, because it kind of encompasses an idea, a stereotype of what a bathhouse is to people that are both straight and gay.
Yeah. The sort of first answer to that is, you know, I wasn't concerned from a titling perspective. Actually, that was the title the draft had, and it stuck throughout the process because it started to become a real draw for folks on the industry side before it was out in the world. The reason I love it is because it sets expectations. No one's going to get in, hopefully, no one's going to get into this book and open it and be shocked that there's sex on the page, be shocked of the sorts of, you know, again, settings and scenes and plot points that they're going to encounter. You know, the more and more I can align reader expectations with what they're going to deliver, the better off I think I'm going to be and the book's going to be as its creator. But the second part to that question is, you know, yes, I do have conflict inside me when it comes to using a bathhouse, you know, which is a safe space, or Grindr, safe spaces that are necessary for queer folks where we've collectively come together and said, you know, it's because we can't, you know, necessarily be ourselves or at the time in public, we can't, some of us still, I have an issue with PDA in public even still, then, you know, we've collectively decided there are these safe spaces for us to be ourselves and make connections and do whatever else we plan to do on Grindr. And that I'm using that in a plot as a vehicle for danger. Yes, I worried about that. On the other side of that, I also think Tinder's fine to use in a book and no one says anything. Or if someone almost got strangled in a grocery store, you know, am I really painting Food Lion in a negative light? Hopefully not. The reason I can't come up with a better answer for that is because it's something I'm actively still thinking about. But this was the best story I could tell, told in the best way I could tell it at the time. And so I did my best to make sure I did everything justice and delivered for readers and on behalf of our community.
Yeah, I just wonder, because you're trying to normalize it. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. It shouldn't be transgressive. So I guess from that angle, Like, what's transgressive about you know, folk consenting adults, you know, taking part in an activity, you know, sex in the case of a bathhouse, which is just as evolutionarily compelled as you know, drinking and eating. It shouldn't be so transgressive, and that's something I stand behind it and proud of the way I presented it. I hope.
Yeah, but I wonder if doing that takes away the safe space part of it.
Oh, I hope I haven't given people ideas. I mean, to be honest, if someone's a sociopath, well, they're going to do something horrible. They're going to be creative, right, and find a place to do it.
Yeah.
Well, I think not only necessarily kill, but I think that the more we open up our lifestyle to the general public, it opens up to more of, you know, them being aware of what we do and what our lifestyle is. And I think sometimes that's a bit of a surprise for some people.
I see your point there for sure. And I will say, if bathhouses, for whatever reason, become like a bachelorette party destination, I will come back on this show and apologize profusely to every single person in the community.
Yeah, the Bachelor 2022, they're going to be live from the bathhouse.
You'll just have to write your next thriller and call it the Bachelorette Party.
The best. Yeah. It'll be like one by one, Agatha Christie style or something.
Right. Yeah. And then Norma.
Well, and so did you, you know, I was going to say, and I do this quite often with fiction writers, do you go out and look for information to write about a story, such as crime and things like this, from going out and being part of different parts of society, I say. So did you get your experience from going to bathhouses? Is this sort of something you draw from?
I mean, I have done all the I had done all the research on the bathhouse and Grindr and all that toxic relationship front well before I knew I was ever going to be writing about it exhaustively. And so, yeah, like we were just talking about, there are these aspects of the community that we all know about, or most of us, you know, whether we choose to engage in them or not, you know, they're there and we're acutely aware of them. And so, you know. Yeah, I just totally lost my train of thought.
That's all right. Your mind went into the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
no, I just, you know, because a lot of times, you know, when you're writing about a, you know, there's a story. This is a thriller, and there's things going on. You've got a story going on, and sometimes people put themselves in that situation. They learn from experience because they don't live that way normally. And I'm just wondering what kind of things you did to get the story together, that's all.
Yeah, so I'm a very anxious person, just constantly. And so my mind is catastrophizing all the time, figuring out what's the worst thing that could possibly happen, often to my own detriment, you know, when I, for whatever reason. And so there's been plenty of times where I was like, you know, going to go meet some guy from Grindr, you know, late at night, never a total stranger's apartment that I'm, you know, taking a train over to. And I'm just like, oh, you know, I hope this person doesn't kill me. We will find out. from the books, you know, plotting the book, it was a lot of it was about that anxiety that I had. Like, how would we raise stakes to justify that? Like, I felt like I was, you know, in such danger, you know, perhaps, what could have possibly happened that would have terrifyingly validated that? Or to give another example, with Oliver and his husband, is you know, perfect, older, successful husband Nathan, you know, with their relationship, there have been times where I've had dates with men, and they, you know, have done things that were incredibly off-putting, on a, you know, from even laughable, like trying to order dinner, you know, for on your behalf, or you know, very clearly trying to impress you in a vapid, transparent way. But I could laugh about that, and laugh about it with friends later and never see that person again. But I think to myself, what would have happened if I had been in a position like Oliver, the protagonist in the book, where I felt like I didn't have a choice, where I felt like, oh, well, this free meal I've had ordered on my behalf was good. And also, I don't have food security and I would really love a second one. If I was in that situation, mm-hmm. would I have found myself in a relationship kind of predicated on that dynamic? I've made plenty of mistakes in my life, so I'm sure I could have made that one just as well. So it's kind of about gaming out, right? You know, what bad things could have happened. And that's the sort of personal experience I draw from. The other stuff, I mean, as far as like research, I mean, I've got a medical background. So of course, you know, that stuff is good, or I've got colleagues that can help me out. But as far as research goes, I always sort of get right first and get into trouble later. So it's all about just getting the story out on the page at first, not worrying too much about the details.
Who is Oliver Park to you?
Oliver Park is someone who deserves the opportunity to define themselves on their own. Oliver Park starts this book, or before the story even starts, without having a solid appreciation or understanding of who he is as a human, what he deserves and what he doesn't deserve from other folks. And again, before the story starts, he had found himself at a rock bottom, so to speak, in his life, and was finally positioned to be able to figure out who he is and how he can thrive in life and what he wants out of life specifically. And that happened to be when he met his future partner, Nathan, who said, you know, being a surgeon, I got you. Don't worry about it. I'm going to help point you in the right direction. And that doesn't really help Oliver too much. So it's someone who deserves to go through that process, despite other folks in his life making that challenging for him.
So where do the characters come from for you? Like, do you hear voices in your head, or do you, like, is it someone you've seen in a coffee shop or a bathhouse or something? Like, where do these characters come from?
Yeah, I mean, it's so, again, like, it starts with that feeling, but then the actual voices, it's, you know, it's wherever my brain goes first. If I'm like, okay, so for bathhouse, for example, I wanted to open this book with a high stakes start in a bathhouse, someone almost getting killed. And if that was the setup, who is the person that needs to be there to tell this kind of story? And then, you know, I've sort of, again, mine, you know, maybe I've had a friend who, you know, grew up in a situation very similar to ours.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oliver's. And I know them later in life when they're successful and have overcome all these challenges. And so, you know, I can think through what they must have gone through and what might have gone wrong. Or alternatively, if I just get a feeling that a particular kind of voice sits well, then I'm going with it for no other reason than I just like it. So Nathan's mother, Kathy Klein, is one of those horrible Lucille Bluth type characters who are hilarious on TV, but horrible in real life, I'm sure. And, you know, I was watching a lot of Archer when I was drafting those scenes because, of course, Jessica Walter, who does Lucille Bluth, is there as well. And so I was like, that's a great voice. I'll tap into that one. So stealing is what I'm trying to say. Stealing is where voices come.
So it's a completely plagiarized book is what you're saying. Yeah. Fantastic.
Hey, all fiction is kind of that way.
There we go. No new ideas. No new ideas.
Right.
But
right.
You have a relationship with your it's a weird question to me because I've always written nonfiction, so I don't have relationships with a lot of the characters because, you know, it just doesn't work. But so a lot of fiction writers have told me like they their characters are like their family, they're like their children. I hear all sorts of definitions like that. What is it to you? What are your characters to you?
It depends on the character. For a character like Oliver, I wouldn't say necessarily like family, but almost more of like a projection of all of the sorts of insecurities that, you know, that either I've experienced or other folks have experienced. And because that's sort of baked into that character in all the ways that we've talked about, then there's going to be a high degree of meaningfulness. So an attachment that I have to that character. But as I mentioned earlier, I also have ADHD and I get bored really easily. And so once I feel like I'm finished with, you know, the story and the character, I'm not really, it's not going to hurt me, you know, if someone doesn't like that, even that character, you know. And then on the other side, we've got, you know, ancillary characters that I honestly, you know, didn't realize how much I didn't care about until I was listening to the audiobook and having this dark stuff being read by these fabulous narrators back to me. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that to this person that I, you know, they deserve so much more. So I kind of got retroactively attached in that way. And then for a character like Nathan, he actually didn't even have a point of view in the early manuscripts. And at that point, I wasn't attached to him as much because I was like, oh, this is a controlling guy who thinks he's doing the right thing, but is a jerk and irritating. But when I started getting into his mind and pulling his point of view on the page, I started caring about him because I could connect with what he wants and you know, what's preventing him from getting it on a human level, even if I don't agree with the behavior unfolding.
I thought it was very interesting, the two points of view back and forth between, you know, Nathan and Oliver. That felt a little unusual for like thriller. A lot of thrillers are either lots of points of view, I feel like, or one consistent one versus sort of the back and forth. That was sort of an interesting way to approach that story. And that's interesting. You said it came a little bit later. What made you sort of decide I want to do Nathan, you know, as a point of view?
Yeah. I'm notoriously, my biggest weak spot is I'm an underwriter. So, you know, my stuff gets finished quickly and not nearly as good as other folks. And I have to spend a lot of time on it on the back end. And so that original manuscript was something like 60,000 to 70,000 words. And when it landed on the desk of my, would eventually become my editor, Rob Bloom at Doubleday, he took a phone call with me and said, I love it so much, and went through all the reasons why, and told me, you know, you've got the heart and the lungs and all the organs and, you know, whatever, but you're missing a little bit of connective tissue. How can we really go deeper and make this pop? And then after that conversation, I was thinking through that. And I always try to write a scene from the perspective of whatever character has the most to lose in that scene. Mm-hmm. And I realized there were so many scenes or potential scenes that Nathan had so much to lose and that were happening off the page, that if I could just bring them on the page, it would level up the story, I hope, in a way that wasn't possible without that piece of advice that I had gotten. And yeah, so as far as like, you know, why he's only in there, you know, he's not in there. It's not alternating. Like every chapter is Nathan Oliver,
right,
like you see so many times. It just kind of happened organically that way. And I guess I wanted it to always be Oliver's story. Even if I bring in these other perspectives to make it more entertaining for readers. So hopefully by the distribution of those points of view chapters, it becomes clear that this is Oliver's book, but there are other important people in it.
Yeah, it definitely feels like Oliver's book. I think certainly it feels very, his heart is the heart of the book.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, you know, when we had Matt Lubers Moore on, he talked a lot about LGBT books and large publishers not being interested, and it's still really a hard sale for the big publishers and stuff like that. Now, how do you feel about this situation? Because now you have a fairly successful, very visible book in mainstream. You know, you got O Magazine writing about it. You've got a lot of exposure right now. So how was your experience getting on a larger label and getting it so much attention?
Yeah, it was a challenge. So I published Bathhouse with a different publisher because my agent, Chris Bucci, who, by the way, has been such an advocate for this book for years before it would ever get acquired, didn't get that enthusiastic response that we were looking for a lot of the reasons that I'm sure you can imagine and are implied in the question. And so, you know, we said, you know, obviously, even if we were to be able to make a case, it's not just about getting your book sold, but it's about putting it in the right hands that are going to treat it and position it for success the way that the work deserves. And so we went out on submission, which was a risk on my part, because I have no doubt, I know for a fact, I could have continued, you know, publishing books that were more aligned with what I had done earlier. And I said, you know, no, this is the book I want to, or the story I want to tell. And the submission process, of course, I got plenty of rejections that were the normal stuff that we all get as writers. And then I got, unsurprisingly, you know, passes that you could tell, you know, that this was about more than the book. You know, if you had just published a queer memoir last year, that should not preclude you from publishing, you know, a queer thriller. That's nothing like it. So that was all a bit challenging, because it was validating all the fears that had led me to not write a queer book to begin with at first. But I've got to say, once Doubleday made the offer or asked me to revise and come back, as we had just talked about, it's been an incredible experience, because I have never felt like I have been anything else but another voice at their house, and they have treated me that way. And it's just, you know, the resources they put into the book have been incredible. And the most important thing to me, to come out of that and how I feel about it, particularly now that the book seems to be doing, really, you know, pretty okay, especially with all the exposure, is the business case for these kinds of stories will not be, an excuse that folks could use, because to not acquire more of them. That was my biggest fear. I would go to Doubleday, this huge publisher, have this huge book, and it would sink. And then the next time another author with a story to tell came, it would be, well, let's lower that advance. PJ didn't do so well. Or let's not even acquire them. PJ didn't do so well. And so I know that's cognitive distortion, but it's how I think. And I'm very happy that I don't think that that's a valid reason to pass on a book like this in the future from other new voices.
So what advice would you give to someone, a younger writer that was maybe is in the same position as you are, only not published or trying to get published? What would you say to them?
I would say I was going to say, don't do this, but again, I did this, and it's actually okay. So don't worry if you make mistakes or you think you've made a decision, you know, that kind of limits yourself and you won't be able to write what you want at some point, because that at least in of one, myself, did not pan out that way. So, you know, take that worry off of your plate, but put on your plate the story that you want to tell, and that's it. And be tenacious. If you're, you know, a member of a marginalized community, you're going to have to be more tenacious because you're going to get rejections that other folks don't get. But you're going to get plenty of the other ones as well. So you just have to keep going, and don't quit as long as that's what you want to do. And then, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that the biggest book deal of my life was the one where I finally unfettered myself to write from, again, a queer perspective, even though that's not what, you know, the book necessarily hinges on. And I hope that those writers do exactly that, because I read Bathhouse now and all I see is all the mistakes that I've made or the way word choices were poor. And I know when I read other folks' books that there are better, far, far better writers out there with ideas or books on their computer right now. And I hope that whatever those are the ones that they're going to take out and give us, because we need them. So I'm so long-winded. Be tenacious. There. That's.
What are you trying to say? How has this book changed you in a lot of ways, in the way you write, in the way you are, like when you look back now, you've been through the work, it's all done, it's published, it's out there now. What do you think's changed about you from that?
I both good and bad. So, you know, of course there's the catharsis and being able to tell that story and talk about it and have that voice, which has made me feel empowered. I've felt freer to, you know, be able to take stands and do the right thing without worrying about, you know, for example, if a conference, you know, messages me and wants me to be on a panel with, you know, 16 white straight men, I feel, for whatever reason, maybe because Oprah said something about me in a book or the New York Times or anything else, I feel like I've got a little bit more bulletproofing to tell people no. And say, you know, this isn't a representative panel of the best, you know, whatever genre or whatever topic has to offer. And that's something I would have had more trepidation about in the past. So that's a positive change. But I also have become there's a considerable amount of anxiety and fear, on the other side of it. Because, and as y'all know by now, it doesn't take very much to spike that in me. So it's not like I'm talking about any major challenges, but people, I'm used to being able to tweet stupid stuff that I say and it could disappear into a vacuum. And there's a degree of freedom in that. And now I have to actively work against trying to be, just on all the time, because that's not me. I'm myself as a human. And so trying to be that with the pressure of, will I alienate this person? Or, will I alienate this whole, you know, social media platform of readers or, you know, whatever. So I don't know. There's a little bit of performance anxiety and pressure on the backside that, you know, is something I didn't necessarily anticipate, although I should have. And it's been, I'm getting better at it in terms of thinking about it in healthier ways and not letting things get to me, because my part's already done. I did the work. I wrote the book. And I don't know if that makes any sense whatsoever, but so I'm empowered and afraid. I'm trying to add these sound trying to add these sound bites at the end for the edit.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, there, we've got it. Okay, so listen, where do people find you? Like, do you have a website, Grindr, whatever? Like, how do people get a hold of you?
Yeah, on Grindr, it'll be just a picture of my book. So if you buy it, put it in your apartment, like, that's always a great way to get my attention.
Yeah.
No, wow. I at PJ Vernon Books on Twitter. And at PJ Vernon Books on Instagram as well. And then www.pjvernonbooks.com is my sometimes updated website. So that's where folks, and then the book's available wherever books are sold.
And it's a PJ Bathhouse on Grindr.
There you go.
Perfect. How was the pandemic for you in the sense that does it interfere with your writing? Like, because I imagine you're working on something new now, or you've got something in mind, maybe, and maybe you don't. But during the pandemic, I think the big question is not only the pandemic, but if things around you are rather, let's say, stressful or unhappy, or if you're in a situation where real life is kind of a struggle.
Yeah.
Do you write to get out of it, or does writing sort of incorporate what you're feeling?
Yeah, I'm one of those creative folks that, you know, cannot write in the midst of chaos, whether it's personal or the world. And so I found new words very, very, very difficult throughout this pandemic. I've got a manuscript that I'm working on, you know, that had already been drafted. So I'm working on it. That's a different skill set. I'm able to do that because it's making it better. But that fresh creativity, I just haven't been able to really do it this year. And I'm not punishing myself for it because I think I can barely write an email this year. It takes so much out of you. We all do twice as much work for half the payoff. And so I'm trying not to punish myself for that. And I start to feel now I'm starting to get a little more creative breathing room and getting that appetite of wanting to go and get words on the page. But by and large, the experience has been so disruptive because it's been so at extremes. At 11 a.m., I might get an email that, the New York Times is going to do this book review. And that puts me on cloud nine. And then, you know, at 4 p.m., a family member has COVID. Or at the time, I was fundraising for the local library foundation here. And, of course, because of COVID, it was a lot of trying not to give money back to different organizations for programs and services that the library was unable to fulfill. So there was so much stimulus happening in so many wild directions that I am just glad I've gotten through this without accidentally, like, screen sharing something awful on a Zoom, or, like, you know, if I get out of this making coherent sentences, then I'll start rebuilding from there.
Yeah. Were you having problems getting out of bed, getting the lipstick on? And
you know, that's never been an issue for me because I don't know. I just wear my lipstick to bed for that reason. I've been tattooed on years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you just can't get out of bed, take the hair out of the rollers and all that, you know.
But there's so much stress waiting for you on the other side of that bedroom door. Why would you not want to open it and get out there and experience
it all? Well, that's just it, you know. Well, where do you see yourself going now, like, you know, in the future? Are you gonna keep on writing, where, or are you gonna change the type of writing you're doing, or where do you see yourself?
Well, so I have got a project which again is very dark. I can't talk too much about it, but it's very dark and queer and voyeuristic and all of this kind of stuff. But it's a considerable departure from Bathhouse because in the same way it was important to me to publish Bathhouse after a debut, which is a Southern Gothic suspense. I didn't want to only have to write stories in the South because that's where I'm from. So I did Bathhouse, and I don't only want to now write stories that are, you know, hinge on gay kink, because eventually, after a very long time, I would run out of material. And so it's still a thriller. I hope it's terrifying. I hope it makes people think, but it's going to be different. And the one after that's going to be different because I don't know, writing is really hard, and it's way too hard to do if I feel obligated to do it, as opposed to telling a story that my heart wants to tell.
Hmm. Is suspense a big part of what you write, or is it more just straightforward, you know, I don't want to say violence, but just more straightforward, you know, terror, you know, like what's important to you in a story there?
Yeah, it's the suspense 100%. And I think because it leaves most of the work of creating those fears or fantasies or whatever to the reader. So I'm not a big fan of, I know I do it in places, I'm not a big fan of even telling folks, you know, what my characters look like, because if there's some hot guy strangling you in a bathhouse, I would like it to look like whoever your fantasy person is. Although in that specific example, that was a little bit of authorial intrusion because I put Alexander Skarsgård in there for a reason. So it's those details. If I would rather bring readers into a room and turn the lights off and have them, and only tell them that the lights are off, so that they decide what horrible things are in that room, because it would be different perhaps for all three of us here. I might be afraid of some sort of snake or animal or spider. Someone else might be afraid of a human. Someone else might be afraid of themselves if they're left alone in a room. So not filling in so much that readers are confined, but giving them just enough detail so that their greatest fears are what they're afraid of. A small example is the word moist, like we were joking about, right? If I say moist, I don't have to tell you the blood and gore was moist. I can just tell you it was moist, and then you decide what was moist, and it'll probably be whatever the worst thing you could possibly think of is.
Wow, yeah, I can't even say that. Censor
all those.
Yeah, that's it. What would PJ's biggest secret be? What secret do you want to tell the listeners?
I think that's a good question. I have not committed any felonies, so I'm not worried about copping to those on air. PJ's biggest secret is, I don't know if it's a big secret, but folks don't really believe me. I'm actually sort of an outgoing introvert. I'm very excitable and enthusiastic in person. And so it sometimes doesn't feel that I would be, but PJ's biggest secret is if PJ's left to his own devices, he will close all the blinds and watch YouTube videos on the couch all day long and not go anywhere, never.
See, told you, hair in the rollers.
There you go. But his lipstick looks great.
Yeah, but it's how you look. It's on perfect, you know, all lined up and everything. You ever going to work with another writer, you think?
I don't know. I think I would. I would want to start it small, though, to see how it goes. I'd do something like maybe a short story or so, but hopefully with a writer who can write short stories, because that's probably an important skill set that I don't necessarily have. I'd give anything a shot for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of thought you would.
I moved to Canada without a job. I'll write a book with someone else.
Yeah, what I mean, you can. What more can you do? My God, and in Calgary too. My God. Well, that's as close to the U.S. and Canada as you're going to get.
Yes, it is.
You know, cowboys, oil and gas. You know, what more can you ask for?
I came from Texas, so it was not necessarily new, but no, I'm super happy to be here. It might be the most American city in Canada, but when I hear people, when folks complain about how, you know, oh, the mass transit here is horrible, I'm just like, yeah. Congratulations, you get to not cross a 16-lane highway by foot if you want to go to the corner store.
Yeah, I know. It's quite, it's on a different degree. It's a lot smaller. Yeah, I know. But hey.
And gorgeous.
It's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's all.
You're from Kelowna, you said, right?
That's where I have my big home, yeah.
Ooh, it's gorgeous. I had no idea. I was taking a road trip from Calgary to Vancouver. I'm just realizing this right now. I finished the draft of Bathhouse, the very first draft of Bathhouse, at an Airbnb in Kelowna, because that was the halfway point Calgary to Vancouver.
Did you have fun with the hosts? Maybe it was me.
They weren't there. That was the whole introvert part. But I had no idea that the south of France existed north of Idaho. I was like, oh my gosh, this is gorgeous. What are we getting wrong?
it's the biggest secret of Canada. They know, most people don't realize it's there, and that's fine.
It's horrible. It's a horrible place.
Yeah, don't nobody go there. It's terrible.
Don, you come. Weather. You come,
I,
I've heard terrible things, but I'm
it's
coming.
Terrible. It's awful. It's nothing but dirt and dust. It's just a terrible place to be. Oh.
We got plenty of room at the house. Y'all can come and then tell everyone.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, now our guest has been the one and only author of The Bathhouse, and that's P.J. Vernon. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Alan. I've been looking forward to this, and I appreciate it so much. And John, thank you for all the kind for the review that you gave Bathhouse and those kind words. It meant a lot. I still remember the Thriller Fest in 2017, trying to awkwardly. I was like, "Oh, it's a gay writer. I have to know him." and then it was just like the most.
And then we all like find each other, like you.
I was like, "Hi, I know who you are. Shake your hand." And then you know, like that was awkward, but I feel good because I know John now. So yeah. Thank you.
We all do.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.